welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. This week you have myself, Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Alex Littlefield. And this week we've got what I think is a pertinent topic. Of course, I'm talking about the future, the new, the current Cold War that many believe that the United States is in with China. And we thought we would talk about that. Somebody mentioned that as a topic they'd like to see us discuss. And so that's what we're going to do. So with that, Alex, you are our resident China expert. Of course, you spent, 20 years plus living in China, and you got a PhD from Taiwanese University. So you know the country, you know the people, you know the region. Tell us or kick us off with what you think about this concept of a new Cold War with China.
Okay, yeah, great to be here. Thank you, Curtis and Adam, for having me in place of Jim. And
who's on vacation, by the way?
Yeah. Yes.
Long-deserved vacation.
And this should be a good podcast because Adam today is wearing a KC Royals cap.
And so, you're a Royals fan, by the way, for those who might not know.
Royals fan in D.C., not too many of us. So anyhow, this idea of China and U.S. in a Cold War for the longest time had always been thought of as being a little bit too, detrimental to this relationship with China. The U.S. and China, they needed to work together. Some people would say, oh, we were frenemies, or this thing like Chimerica, where we're so intertwined, connected at the hip, that we just have to make things work out because the good of China and the good of the U.S. depends on the two countries getting along. And this is pretty much a perspective coming from the West, from Americans. But the Chinese all along had already been engaged in their version of a Cold War. So, for example, whenever the U.S. would respond or react in any ways to Chinese aggression, the Chinese would accuse the Americans of, hey, you guys are using a Cold War mentality. While all along, the Chinese were instigating what was actually a Cold War, but they didn't want the Americans to recognize it as such. And if the Americans dared recognize it as such, then we were the ones guilty of starting a Cold War. But there were a few people in academia who were had a pretty good idea what was going on. In particular, I think of Aaron Friedberg. He's a professor at Princeton University. And as far back as the 90s, he wrote an article in International Security called Ripe for Rivalry. So already that's 30 years ago. He was saying that this relationship was ripe for rivalry. Now here we are 30 years later, and now how much further it's gone into this ripening process. The term itself of saying, like, are we in a Cold War, Cold War 2.0, it's frequently given credit to probably Niall Ferguson, because he has a big platform, very well-known figure. But in my defense, and it's a pun intended because it was actually part of my PhD defense, back in 2012, I was already arguing that we were in a Cold War with China. And so I was sort of presenting on this topic going back into 2010. But it just wasn't getting any traction. It was seen as too hawkish, and the U.S., their plan was they call it a goal-averse strategy, like we're just going to enmesh China in all these regimes and these norms, and China's just going to have to follow along with the rules of the system now that it's in the world, the World Trade Organization. But of course, China was able to smash that to pieces.
So you're saying the panda hugging didn't work?
The panda hugging didn't work. Instead, what we ended up with, a bowl in a China? No, and here's another thing with the China shop. But in this case, the China shop belonged to the Americans because it was their world order they were creating, and the bull was Chinese. So anyhow, I think you get the picture.
Sure. Your analogies, are, of course, are always welcome. So yeah. Appreciate that one. So go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, no, that's, I think that I let Curtis chime in on what he wants to add to that.
So Curtis, I mean, you're the, you know, hawkish one, I think, sometimes. So
I don't know about that.
I know I'm just a, you know, an advocate of peace. So
me too. although I am a China hawk.
I'm a panda slugger, not a panda hugger.
That's right. I am not a big fan. So I like to start off with definitions and sort of help our audience understand what do we mean by a Cold War. And so there's difference between a Cold War and the Cold War. And I think it's important that we sort of understand that as an audience, as a learned group here. So I sort of define a Cold War as a condition of geopolitical tension, rivalry, mistrust, and or hostility between nations that does not involve direct military action above the threshold of open warfare. I've chosen my words very carefully, but is pursued primarily through economic and political policies, propaganda, espionage, and even sometimes proxy wars between surrogates. And in this case, I think with China, maybe the proxy war is sort of off to the side, but the others still seem to kind of feel like they're playing. When we think about great power competition, strategic competition, however you want to, whatever political administration definition you're using, there are different ways to look at this. And back in 2021, a professor, Columbia University professor Thomas Christensen wrote that the U.S. strategic competition cannot be labeled a Cold War as it lacks three essential and interrelated elements that define the U.S. And Soviet Union conflict. And I'm actually don't necessarily agree with these, with what he says. Go figure. But let's go through these real quick, and I'll be interested in your all's thoughts as well. So the first one he says is that the United States and China are not engaged in an ideological struggle to win the hearts and minds of third countries. Presumably that's what the U.S. and the Soviet were doing, right? Now, I completely disagree with that, right? So China is a communist organization. It imprisons its minority. Is actively seeking to block the world through the Shanghai Cooperative Organization and the BRICS, as well as usurping current rules-based orders by claiming the South China Sea and suppressing Hong Kong's freedoms, violating its agreement with the United Kingdom that it would honor their freedoms through 2047, and threatening Taiwan repatriation by force, and even threatening Japan with a nuclear attack, clear violation of their own no-first-use policy. So I think the first rule or first definition by Professor Christensen's kind of out of the water. His second definition is that, hey, the United States and China are not leading alliances that could foster proxy wars or precipitate nuclear crises. Well, again, you know, this is 2021. We look at AUKUS, the Quad, in addition to existing ANZUS agreements and other bilateral defense agreements with the Republic of Korea, Japan, the Philippines, etc. So we see here that there are some of these alliances that are coming out. And even with China, we now have this without limits relationship between China and Russia that Xi and Putin have signed and exchanged little red books over. And of course, North Korea is a vassal state, and China enjoys very close relationships with Iran, Venezuela, Cambodia, Djibouti, and other Belt and Road Initiative customers. So again, there are a bit more or less alliances, relationships, partnerships, however you want to define that or the varying degrees thereof. So I think rule number two actually is not holding water either. And the third one here is that the global economy has become so integrated that it cannot be separated into blocks, and thus a containment strategy will not work. Well, we are actively seeing now a decoupling process, right, between portions of America, of the American economy and other Western democracy economies with China. COVID-19 and the efforts post COVID-19 really showed the world that that there were some challenges in the supply chains coming from China, that they may not have been as predictable or as
reliable.
Reliable. So I would say that I would say the Chinese have purposely indebted nations through the BRI. There's accusations of currency manipulation, a weaponization of the global economy, and predacious behavior concerning the cornering of STEM markets, biomedical, et cetera, as well as the issue of fentanyl and some of these other efforts. There's a lot of miscreant type of behavior that sort of comes out of this. And I always like to point back to the 1999 book Irregular Warfare, published by those two Chinese National Defense University colonels, that really sort of laid out the plan of how China wants to really sort of corner the market. I don't know if they want to be the global hegemon, but they certainly want to be the regional hegemon. And they're using multiple methods to do this. And I think the idea that are we approaching a Cold War, a little C, little W, I think is definitely the case. And whether or not we want to call it a Cold War 2.0 with a capital C and a capital W, that may be up for debate.
Yeah, the things that I sort of think about, you know, I would follow along with what both of you have said in terms of sort of where we are and what's going on. But I think about the differences between China and the Soviet Union in the sense, for example, you know, the Chinese economy, the Soviet economy was never more than 10 to 15% of the U.S. economy. I mean, the Russian economy's essentially 1/20th the size of the U.S. economy right now, whereas, you know, the Soviet economy was about a tenth the size. The Chinese economy is, what, 80, 90% the size of the American economy. And it may not catch the American economy like some predicted. They've seen some bumps, but 80% the size, that's a lot bigger than the Soviets ever were. They've got a lot more intellectual talent. I mean, the Soviet Union never had, you know, 1.5 billion people. So even if it's a smaller percentage, it's still, you know, a lot larger. You know, the China's cyber army is, you know, is larger than most of the U.S. Army's fighting forces. They've got, you know, bigger economy, more people. You know, they've cornered the market on critical minerals. Our economy is dependent upon China. We were never dependent upon the Soviets for anything. We exported food, a country as big as the Soviet Union, and we had to export food to the Soviet Union. You know, we're dependent upon their manufacturing, China's. We were never dependent upon the Soviet Union's manufacturing. So in many respects, while there may be a Cold War, it's a very different Cold War because China is a much more prescient threat because of its economic, technological, and other capabilities than the Soviet Union ever was. And so if we thought we were losing to the Soviets, which many Americans were fearful that we were losing or going to lose to the Soviets, I guess I say, well, if you thought that was where we could lose, then how much more challenging is China, which has such a greater ability to cause harm? And I sort of open that up to the both of you, maybe. Alex, if you want to go first, am I thinking in the right vein or am I sort of wrong in you know, the way I'm looking at this?
No, it's good you brought up the Russians, the Soviets, and going back to Curtis there. It's a mistake for anyone to say, well, this does not mirror precisely what was going on between the Soviet Union and the United States, therefore it can't be a Cold War. It's kind of like saying, what happened between Athens and Sparta and what happened in 1812, those aren't wars because they're so different. But it's a war where there's, in some sense, there's preparation for war, which may actually result in a hot war. And on the case of the Chinese, they are making all kinds of preparations for a hot war. And there's a term there, hearkening back to that dissertation way back when, as a model, there's a concept of social constructivism, that the more countries interact, that interact with each other through channels, through that there's going to be some kind of trust that builds, that comes about through all this communication, track one, track two, channels. But my argument was that, why is it that more communication needs to result in trust? Why can't more communication result in distrust? And so,
what's that saying? You know, familiarity breeds contempt.
Exactly. And I actually spoke with Onuf in person. He was like one of the people who brought social constructivism into international relations. And I asked him, why can't it go towards a negative? And he said, no, it's only focusing towards a positive. I said, logically, can it go negative? He was like, no, it doesn't work like that. But we know in reality, it does work like that, because, you know, if it didn't, then every first date would result in marriage, but it doesn't work like that. It's not the more communication, the more people trust each other and like each other.
That would by nature mean that people get married and they don't get divorced, because
that too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There'd be no divorce. Everything would be hunky dory. So actually, I came up with a term in that dissertation. It never caught traction because I'm an unknown guy from an unknown university. But I called it a tepid war. So we were moving from a metastasizing Cold War becomes then what is a tepid war. And so I think we need a few more terms or concepts in the toolbox so we don't just keep thinking Cold War. You know, we think of Soviets and the Americans. This is way more complex. And being think deterrents, it's not just nuclear. You know, the Chinese, without even touching their nuclear arsenal, they can already, I think you mentioned in one of your earlier podcasts, they can make us blind and deaf and everything else, dumb, without even touching that. You know, in space, they can knock us out. They can really put us in a position where, hey, we're going to be screaming uncle and nuclear hasn't even happened. So they've been prepping for war for a very long time. And they're ready for a war. Now I think they're just kind of probably looking for the opportunity. And here we are still having conversations. Is it a cold war? Is it not? Well, actually, folks, we're on the verge of a hot war now while we're still having this conversation. And people like I hate to use names, but Christensen, there, that article, those are the same arguments that have been around for a very long time in terms of, I mentioned it too, so I'm not going to repeat, but that we were so economically integrated that war couldn't even mean that you should probably go into to an asylum because you had such a crazy thought there. But now people like no longer with us, but I forgot his name. The foreign minister under Nixon, Secretary
Kissinger.
Of State.
Oh, Kissinger, yeah.
Kissinger, right. Even Kissinger, near the end of his life, was saying, yes, the U.S. and China are now in a Cold War. And he, once he finally came around, you know, okay, well, even he's saying it, so now it's acceptable now to say that we are in a Cold War. But for the longest time, to say that would just you'd be blacklisted for
being too hawkish.
To be new, too hawkish, and I have a personal axe there to grind. Is I had an article that was accepted to an SSCI journal. It was already accepted, was in the editing process, and suddenly they pulled the plug and said they're not going to publish it. And that was actually my Cold War II article that was going to make me famous, if you can say that, being published back in 2012. Finally, okay, it's not just in the dissertation, but now actually it's going to be in a journal. So now all I can do is like be one of those unknown people who stand around probably like the characters in King of the Hill, where they stand by the fence.
That's right.
So I'll just become one of those guys.
Well, let me say this. I mean, Alex, we'll make you famous here in NIDS. I love the idea of a tepid description. I think you should flesh that out a little more. Maybe there's a better word, but I think you're right. There needs to be a new word invented. Maybe that's you. Maybe that's this time. I want to add just a couple thoughts here to you before, Adam, before you run off on the next line here. And that is, as in the Soviet Union, I think we traded maybe 4% of our trade, of our total, was with the Soviet Union. And of course, with China, it's you know, it's well over 30%. In fact, we often carry a trade deficit. Thank you. And so what we bear in this difference here is that it was always, you know, we were always embargoing technology on the Soviets. You know, for them to get blue jeans or computers or whatever, it was a big deal. And it was often done through illicit means. Here, we're all in business with the adversary, right? When we trade, I think it's one of the rules that we should always understand is that trading with your adversary is probably bad for your sovereignty and security. And to your point, Alex, you're right. Right, democracies and capitalists. Well, I mean, the Chinese, of course, are not a democracy, but they always said that democracies don't go to war with one another. And then they sort of said, well, you know, countries that do business with one another don't go to war with one another. Well, this is the exception, right? This is because we've used the business, or I should say, the Chinese have used the business to infuse capital to essentially rebuild their entire capability and fuel their ambitions. I like to remind the audience that the Chinese were admitted into the World Trade Organization a week after 9/11 in September of 2001. And since then, the American economy has grown a whopping 100% over those years. Fantastic growth. But the Chinese have grown over 1,000%. I mean, it's big, big numbers. And they have very much benefited. And the goal of bringing China into the World Trade Organization was the hopes that doing business and having the capital available to them and having their goods and services equally exposed into the global marketplace would somehow democratize China, somehow pacify whatever issues they had and goals they wanted. But that completely did not happen. It has been used as a means to fuel their ambitions, to rebuild their military, to rebuild their infrastructure, and then to leap out ahead of us. And I mean, there are fewer examples. Jim's not with us today, but there are fewer examples of where we may be, especially in the military side, where we may be leading the technological race as opposed to them. And so this is of great concern. And we've allowed the Chinese economy to really act in a predacious manner against our own best interests, against our economy. And this has really caused a lot of constriction. And this is why we have these import-export deficits and why we are losing intellectual capital. You know, the U.S. government estimates $650 billion a year is lost to China in intellectual capital. That is huge amounts of money.
Yes.
Huge amounts of money that we are losing for whatever reason. If it's, outright theft all the way to, you know, this idea that if you're going to build anything in China, you're required to share the technology with them. And so these are great issues. And the result is that even as of 2021, so it's even worse today, but even as of 2021, China was the second largest economy in the world in nominal dollars. If you include purchase power parity, China's the number one economy in the world. And that is something that is of great concern. And what does all that mean? It was just published today that China has begun to float their third aircraft carrier. And it isn't one of your cheapo ski jumpy things. It is a replica of the Ford class with angle decks and all of this stuff. They are moving fast in what they do, in how they build their military capabilities. they're not doing this just to show. They are doing this for a purpose, and it is really to challenge not only the U.S., but the entire Western position here.
Yeah, I wonder what it's going to take, you know, this idea of, you know, because of trade, we're not going to fight. You know, you guys all remember the famous book from 1911 that said that, you know, the European powers wouldn't fight anymore because they were too tied together because of trade, you know, the grand illusion.
Right.
And, of course, it was wrong. And we're now in this situation where we have a lot of folks who still are saying, you know, that just trade is too tight. We're too dependent. They're too dependent. If we stop trading, if we go to war and stop trading, they'll sink and we'll sink. But I think the Chinese have, for the most part, planned for that. Am I wrong, Alex?
Yeah. So all along, they when they brought in Western know-how, their intention was just to use it until they could copycat it themselves and get rid of the original provider of that technology. You know, it's nothing wrong or bad about China with a large population having the largest economy in the world. That's great. But the problem is how they came about doing that. And, you know, we meaning the Americans for their part, especially corporations, have been also very complicit to helping this rise of China, and not in a good way. Just one quick example, Cisco Systems, they helped China build its great firewall, which was used to, prevent average Chinese from accessing information. And the idea there from people I've spoken with at Cisco was, well, if we don't build it, someone else will build it. So we might as well build it and get the money for doing that. But you're basically, you're doing a deal with the devil. And it wasn't just Cisco, but the United States as a whole was doing a deal with the devil. I think the idea back then was there was this concept that any two countries that had a McDonald's wouldn't go to war with each other. So if China had a McDonald's and we have McDonald's, we're not going to fight. But of course, over time, the plan all along was on the Chinese side was to just get what they can take from us and become independent of us and not have to rely on us, but instead have us rely on them. And that's kind of the direction it's going, right? The area where they still rely upon us they're going gangbusters to try and catch up and surpass us so that they don't need to rely on us for anything, and that we are the ones who are beholden to them in every field that imaginable. So it just goes on and on, and there's a lot of anecdotes of products and services that Americans were expecting that they can make money on in China, and it just never happened.
So in 60 seconds, because we're getting near the end of the show, so in 60 seconds, Curtis, I want you to give me your solutions for this problem.
Okay, in 60 seconds, my solution is I think we definitely need to decouple as much of our economy, everything from making rubber doggy toys all the way to high-tech microchips, as much as we can decouple and bring back to the United States. And if we're looking for cheaper labor, we have other more friendlier nations that we can work with that would love to have those factories and those abilities to work. Whether they're in Southeast Asia, Latin America, African
Western
nations, whatever.
Africa, Latin America, our neighbors.
Right, exactly. So I think that this is an issue. I think the second thing that we have to address, we really have to understand and acknowledge that China is conducting a gray zone warfare against us. And it's more than just little blue men in the South China Sea. And I'm pointing largely and the espionage within the U.S., the cyber work and all that. I'm talking also about fentanyl and so forth. Adam, Alex, as you know, I wrote an article recently on that fentanyl needs to be declared a threat to national security. And that's because of what is going on with how much China is shipping in here through their methodologies. And they've outrightly said, we're not going to do anything to prevent this because you're not helping us with the Taiwan question, right? And so you know, there are 70,000 Americans a year being killed by fentanyl. That's more or that's twice as much as the Nagasaki bomb. The last month or back in March, the director of the FBI there, Christopher Wray, testified before Congress that in the last 2 years they seized enough fentanyl to kill 80% of the American population. That is, hundreds of millions of people. And that is even more than we ever predicted in a massive nuclear laydown from the Soviet Union as far as percentages of the population. And we just simply accept this behavior, we ignore it, and we do nothing about it. We leave the borders open and these sorts of things that can try to prevent this. That they are at war with us, and we seem to refuse because of the almighty dollar, the interest in trade, and willingness to accept slave labor.
You took 180 seconds, so...
Okay, I got one last thing I'm going to leave you here. Okay, so those are my... I want to leave our listeners with one, the famous quote from Stalin, right? He said that when we hang the capitalists, we will use the ropes that they sold us.
Yeah, there you go. That's it right there. Okay, Alex, 60 seconds.
But I'll at least, maybe not as good as Curtis, but at least I'll try and stay in my 60 seconds.
No, you got to make me look better by going longer.
All right. So with onto the decoupling, if we're going to do that, though, we need to make it possible for industry to actually work here. So some of these quotas, hiring quotas we have are a little bit ridiculous. I guess a fab that we're trying to open in the Southwest, they couldn't hire enough ex-cons to work in the fab. So, they were required by law to hire a certain number of ex-cons. So, we need to be realistic. There's a reason things are done in China because they have laws that are more favorable, like to the extreme, right? So there's probably a sweet spot where we respect the rights of laborers and workers and all that good stuff without right. putting undue burdens on the capitalist. Since we are Think Deterrence, this is NIDS, I would argue for if we're going to get a quick fix, we need to a dead hand. I think you two are familiar with that.
And we've heard of it, maybe. Yeah. I think I've heard of it.
I can't recall who the authors of that concept are. And then we need way more in terms of nuclear firepower. So we need to be ready. So if we do suddenly go dark, we can't see, we can't hear, we can't communicate. We know that, well, we have enough things to retaliate, and that you can't just do that to us and threaten us that, hey, we have a hyperglide vehicle that's nuclear armed right off your coast and we can hit you in about 2 minutes. So surrender now. We're going to hit you. We're like, okay, too late. We already got a bunch of things aiming, flying towards you right now. So that the enemy is aware we are going to do that. No matter how much pressure you put on us, you're going to feel pain for doing that. And we're not going to just crumple up and say, scream uncle. So that's what we need to do.
We'll cut the lights back on in a very bright way. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I think you guys, for the most part, said it. It's a challenge. I think we all sort of have a consensus that we've got a problem and it's one we've got to address. So, of course, we'll leave it to you, the listeners, to make your own decisions. And maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong. If you think we're right or wrong, feel free to drop us an email. We read your email, and a lot of times we respond back to you. So send us an email. Tell us what you think. And, of course, we want to thank you for joining us on this episode. And, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.